case is number 05-3812, Timothy McKinney against Robert McLean. Mr. Williams.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Brad Williams. I represent the defendant and appellant, Robert Duplain. This appeal is about a 10-second span of time in Jane Poole's backyard on the morning of November 8, 2003. That 10 seconds is start to finish. The 10 seconds culminated, tragically, in a police action shooting. Even after granting the estate the benefit of every reasonable inference, the admissible evidence before the district court on summary judgment demonstrates that Officer Duplain fired only after he was charged. The complaint itself, which I parenthetically note has never been amended, asserts much the same thing as paragraph 16. At the point in time where this event occurred, Officer Duplain was alone. He was separated from assistance from his fellow officers. He had nowhere to retreat because of a dense privacy hedge and uneven soil garden immediately behind him. And his service weapon was drawn and available to a charging assailant if that assailant could reach him. Eyewitness testimony established that from the time Mr. McKinney began his charge, he covered the distance to Officer Duplain in about 2 seconds. No deadly force case ever presented to this court involved a shorter time span. Under those circumstances, we contend Officer Duplain's entitlement to qualified immunity was clear. But the district court denied our motion for summary judgment on that ground. We contend the district court committed error in two fundamental ways. First, the district court, we believe, misread Tennessee versus Garner and held, in essence, that Tennessee versus Garner required that in order to be eligible for qualified immunity, an officer using deadly force must confront an armed suspect. The district court said as much in its entry at page 8. We contend that Garner does not create such a per se rule, and that the decisions addressing it do the opposite. In any event, Garner was a fleeing felon case, as is most of the decisions cited by the district court and by the estate. This is not a fleeing felon case. This is a charging felon case. We submit that the second error the district court committed was that it relied on expert testimony, expert evidence, that should have been excluded as speculative and inadmissible. In making this argument, we recognize that expert evidence can create, in the proper circumstance, a genuine issue of material fact. So in order to accept our argument, you have to accept two premises. First, expert evidence at the summary judgment stage must be admissible. That's Rule 56. Second, the admissibility of evidence, and especially proffered expert evidence, is a question of law. Now that we have the benefit of over a year's worth of discovery on this case, and information that wasn't available on November 8, 2003, I have the opportunity to summarize a couple of critical facts that took place in Jane Poole's backyard. We know that at 3:25 a.m., approximately, Muncie Police Dispatch reported an emergency situation at Jane Poole's house, 1325 West North Street in Muncie. The emergency was a burglary in progress of an occupied residential dwelling in the nighttime hours, and worst of all, with contact lost with the caller, which led the officers on the scene to reasonably believe that whoever was trying to get in the house succeeded. Muncie Police, who are not the employers here, they're a different agency, but Muncie Police took this call so seriously that they dispatched four of their own officers to the scene, 25% of the total available force at that hour. Muncie Police also asked for Ball State's assistance because Ball State's police officers patrolled the area near the scene. Eight police officers responded in all. The four Ball State officers arrived first, separately at all about the same time. Two of them, including Officer Duplain's shift supervisor, Corporal Bell, approached the back of Gene Poole's house from the east side. But the two officers were unable to gain access to the backyard because of a 6-foot privacy fence, shadow box type, that ran the length of the east side of the backyard. Officer Duplain saw his colleagues go up the east side, he went up the west side, a maneuver, I should point out, that nobody objected. But in order to navigate this trip, he had to navigate a narrow, rough stone pathway that was wedged in between the side of Jane Poole's house and a dense hedge that also ran the length of the west side of the property. But there was no privacy fence on the west side of the house. When Officer Duplain reached the backyard, he saw a person standing about 10 to 15 feet away on what turned out to be a 1-foot-tall root mound. The individual was elevated at about that height above the level of a concrete patio, which occupied most of the yard, and that's where Officer Duplain stood. The individual was standing next to a large tulip tree. And if you go to the appendix to our brief at page A10, you'll see a color photograph that clearly depicts the relative location of the large tulip tree, the concrete patio, and the hedge. I submit that there is no serious dispute about anything I've told you, Your Honors, up to this point. But now we come to the part that provoked all of the expert evidence. We have two independent, non-police eyewitnesses who observed the entire sequence of events. From the second-story bedroom window, located on the house to the west, about 70 feet away. Based on my pacing, that distance is roughly equivalent to the left edge of the courtroom, as I point to it, to the opposite edge. That's how far away they were. Mr. Ellis,
they were alerted, the Ellis's were alerted by the phone call, right?
After Mrs. Poole hung up from talking to Delaware County 911, she called the Ellis's.
Which is apparently why Delaware 911 couldn't get back to her.
Yes. Delaware County didn't know the reason, but that's why she made the call.
So they went to the window and watched.
Correct.
After she said the police were on the way.
Correct. She told them not to come over because the police were in the house. From that vantage point, Mr. and Mrs. Ellis saw Officer Duplain enter the backyard. And in less than 10 seconds, they both saw Mr. McKinney charge Officer Duplain before shots were fired. Now, in response to what we think is crystal clear eyewitness testimony, the estate turned entirely to experts. I will deal with the so-called police procedures experts if time permits, but the district court never referred to them at all.
Well, you talk about the gatekeeping function in Daubert's test. What did the district judge do with regard to evaluating the admissibility of this evidence?
The district court did not rule on any issue we raised with the experts, never discussed the reliability or any aspect of admissibility or adequacy of the evidence.
This was furnished to the court by affidavit, the expert testimony.
Mr. Balash and Dr. Spitz's depositions were presented. Dr. Baden submitted a 3-page affidavit.
And you objected to the admissibility of those?
We spent the better part of 8 pages in our reply stating that this evidence was irrelevant, that it was speculative, that it constituted naked conclusions unsupported by any factual foundation, but none of those issues were ruled on by the district court. A brief discussion of Dr. Spitz. His testimony was based on the premise, on the assumption, that Officer Duplain fired 4 shots at Mr. McKinney while he was still standing next to the tulip tree, and that Mr. McKinney fell at the tulip tree. To explain the fact that the blood stains and pool of blood were found in the center of the concrete patio, Dr. Spitz assumed that Mr. McKinney's body had been moved by someone from the side of the tulip tree to the center of the concrete patio. No one else testified to that, thought it happened. There was no evidence of it.
Was he the one that said that all the shots were from a distance?
His testimony can be interpreted in that way. And the reason that's interesting to us is that Dr. Spitz did say one thing that everyone agrees with. He opined that all 4 shots to Mr. McKinney's body one to the left chest, one to the left cheekbone, one to the left arm, one to the left side. That all four shots were at a steep downward angle, 30 to 55 degrees above the horizontal plane. Dr. Smith also testified that Mr. McKinney turned at some point during the shot sequence, which is exactly what the Ellison testified to. For his part, Mr. Balazs disagreed. He admitted the shots probably couldn't have been fired from a distance because of that downward angle. The only thing, if you read the actual testimony and not what a brief says about it, the only thing Mr. Balazs opined was that Mr. McKinney was more than 3 to 4 feet away when the third shot was fired, but within 5 to 6 inches of Officer Duplain when the fourth shot was fired. But everyone in this case agrees. The third and fourth shots were fired in rapid succession. That's the estate's brief at page 17. And several experts. Those two shots were almost instantaneous. So even according to Mr. Balazs, Mr. McKinney managed to close the distance between himself and Officer Duplain from more than 4 feet to less than a foot in a matter of an instant. And again, that's exactly what the Ellison testified to. They saw Mr. McKinney continue to advance toward Officer Duplain after the first shot was fired. This expert evidence, and Dr. Baden threw in an opinion that it was likely his word that Mr. McKinney was initially shot in some hunched, bent over position that no one saw, but didn't indicate where Mr. McKinney was when he sustained those wounds. This is the type of bottom line evidence that this court has rejected whenever it's been offered by an expert. In short, to the extent it established anything, the expert evidence amounted to some isolated facts that were consistent with what the eyewitnesses saw. But when the estate tried to extrapolate this evidence into an alternate theory of what happened in the backyard, it became pure speculation. It should have been disregarded. Had it been disregarded, Officer Duplain's entitlement to qualified immunity would have been clear, and that is the determination we now ask this court to make. Your Honors, no case in this court's jurisprudence, no case in any court's jurisprudence, holds that the Constitution required Officer Duplain to physically grapple, to wrestle with a charging subject in the hope that he was the stronger of the two, or in the hope that his service revolver wouldn't be taken, the service weapon wasn't a revolver, wouldn't be taken away and used against him. After a year and a half worth of discovery, we now have a fairly good idea of what happened in the backyard. Officer Duplain did not have the benefit of that information. He alone had to act based on the information known to him at the time. And what he knew at the time was this was an emergency, this was a burglary, and someone was targeting him and gave him 2 seconds to make a decision. This case is emotionally difficult. This case is tragic, but it is exactly what qualified immunity is all about. And we think Officer Duplain is entitled to that.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Clifford Steiger on behalf of the appellee counsel. As we've indicated in our brief, with all due respect to counsel, counsel misapprehends the proceeding before which we are here today on the limited basis granted by the United States Supreme Court in Peltier for this court to hear on an interlocutory appeal the issue solely of qualified immunity as a matter of law. In order to decide that issue, the facts are taken in a light most favorable to the non-moving party. We're not here, with all respect to this court, to make decisions about the defendants' claims as to the rightness of their facts or the wrongness of our facts, or whether the argument being made here, that which can't possibly be on appeal, that somehow the court abused its discretion by allowing forensic pathologists and ballistic experts to opine as to trajectory and bullets, because if that was an issue in this case, which it's not, and it qualified.
I don't think that's the question whether they can opine. The question is whether they should have been able to submit that material in the first place.
Right, but that's, and I understand that. That
is the gatekeeping thing which we're talking about.
Yes, sir. But that would not be relevant in this interlocutory appeal. That might be relevant if, in fact, we go to trial and there's an adverse verdict to the defendant, and that's an issue on appeal. But I don't believe qualified immunity allows the defendant then to make additional arguments about what evidence should or can be considered. Because if that's...
Well, summary judgment isn't supposed to be admissible evidence?
Admissible evidence, that's correct, but I doubt...
Well, I don't know if it's admissible unless it's the district judge does his gatekeeping and responsibility.
In all fairness, I think recognized experts in ballistics, trajectory, and forensic pathology, if those are not recognized sciences in which experts have universally given opinions and thousands of people are in prison regarding that.
I don't disagree with you. The right. question is, were these specific witnesses qualified to give that evidence?
And I don't believe on summary judgment. I honestly don't. I'm not familiar of any proceeding on summary judgment where the court, in addition to having a motion heard on summary judgment, these are otherwise qualified experts, where the court holds a hearing in advance of the motion for summary judgment, so then determines what evidence the court can consider on the motion for summary judgment.
Suppose somebody submitted an affidavit based on hearsay evidence. Wouldn't the court be required to determine whether that was hearsay evidence or whether or not it qualifies as one of the exceptions to the hearsay rule in advance of deciding the summary judgment?
Yes, and I think that on the basis of the court's ruling, you can assume that the court made such a determination. I'm not familiar.
Here, why doesn't the judge, as Katie stated, by a parity of reasoning, why doesn't the court have the authority here to say, yeah, this expert's testimony is admissible, or no, it is not, and therefore it will be disregarded at summary judgment because it would have to be regarded at trial as well?
Here, the court would have no factual basis upon which to make such a determination. And those facts are not the basis upon which a qualified immunity question is reviewed. This court would have no facts upon which to make such a basis a determination at all.
What about a remand on that issue?
And then what you're suggesting, and I'm telling you, you're starting a labyrinthian process. You're suggesting that all cases now in the Seventh Circuit, before we get here, which delays the proceedings even more, before we get here, we're going to have now Daubert hearings on motions for summary judgment. So what you have now, in order to bring a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment, you have to have Daubert hearings in advance to determine the admissibility of evidence being considered at summary judgment.
Then you'll have the rule required.
And then you'll have the summary judgment hearing. Then you'll have, so that's two hearings. Then you'll have the interlocutory appeal before you. Because I believe the gatekeeper role is what is, I don't think there's any legitimate argument, frankly, that board certified and otherwise qualified forensic pathologists and ballistic experts are qualified to give opinions. I think that's on its face a disingenuous argument.
They're qualified to give opinions. We also, it's a de novo review from the summary judgment. We have the same affidavits. We have the same depositions. And you can look at what their opinions are. And if their opinions are totally speculative, based on what shots that went through clothing, and that if they are so speculative that they really should not be, we can make that decision.
Well, except that isn't speculative. The fact that, for instance, we have the clothing here, that somebody takes a look at the clothing and sees that the shots are in the back of the jacket rather than the front. What's speculative about that? I mean, to say that that's speculative is to say that the sun comes up in the morning, tomorrow morning is going to be speculative. That's not. These forensic experts take a look at not only the trajectory of the shots, but the physical evidence. The physical evidence in this case was that the shots occurred in the back. Now, the defendant continually argues to this court that Mr. McKinney was shot coming at him.
When the pathologist identified, the one who did the autopsy, they identified where the shots went.
Yeah, okay.
And they were, he indicated earlier, the shoulder and the side and under the eye and in the heart.
Right. But the clothing shows the shots came from the back.
And the undisputed evidence is these shots were in rapid sequence. Maybe there was some hesitation between the first and second and the third and fourth. There was rapid fire. The witnesses who saw it, the only reason they were watching is because they received the phone call. and they, so they're looking out the window and watching the whole thing. They talked about him lunging forward, leading with his left shoulder, which was perhaps the first two shots. That makes sense with it, with pathologists identified. And then the last two had to be at close range. I think even your experts, at least a couple of them, they seem to be internally squinting. But one of them said that the last shot, the eye had to be very close.
Not that close, but the fact of the matter is that the eyewitnesses are no more reliable for the purposes of this opinion, this proceeding, than our experts who have testified quite clearly. And the physical evidence, which shows that Michael McKinney was shot in the back and then shot in the head as he fell forward. Now, that's the physical evidence from which, I guess the claim here is that this court now needs to resolve questions of fact, not in the light most favorable to us, notwithstanding the fact that we presented an avalanche of testimony in our favor, but also resolve questions of fact in the light most favorable to them, or resolve disputed issues of fact according to ways the court wants to resolve them. And I don't think either of those is appropriate. The law is quite clear that you... that any disputed issues of fact, assuming they're disputed, legitimate disputed issues of fact, which would show from our perspective that this conduct was objectively unreasonable and that it was a clearly established constitutional right and excessive force is as clearly established.
But it's got to be more specific than excessive force. We all know excessive force is wrong. Constitution.
That's correct.
But you go beyond that. It's not just a matter of generic terms. Say, well, that's clearly established excessive force. We claim excessive force, therefore.
No, right. The objectively unreasonable conduct, or the objective reasonableness of the conduct. Now, you have also, in addition to this testimony, you have the testimony of the chief of police of Muncie. You have the testimony of the deputy chief of police of Muncie. You have the testimony of the former head of Ball State, which all said the conduct was objectively unreasonable.
Well, why then did four police officers come from Michigan City and three from the school based on an emergency where there was a burglary in progress and the person who called 911 hung up and was cut off?
Well, that's an assumption that isn't borne out.
No, that's the objective fact.
That is not. And just the facts are that a woman calls and says, somebody's pounding on my door. Nobody made any claim of a burglary. Then she hung up the phone.
What was reported by the 911 operator?
I don't know. The 911 operator, apparently, it's like the game of telephone that used to play. Somebody calls and says, somebody's pounding on my door. The 911 operator says, burglary in progress. That doesn't justify anyone coming to a backyard and shooting down somebody in the backyard.
Wait a minute. What the officer knew was a burglary in process, not that somebody was just pounding on a door.
No, the officer didn't know anything. The officer had been told. The officer didn't know anything. The officer, even assuming that...
All right, what was he told?
If he was told there was a burglary in progress, that's fine. But you can't, from a perspective of a reasonable officer, you can't take that and say, and therefore anyone that I find leaning against a tree in a backyard, I can shoot. That's not... conduct that's acceptable. Also the suggestion that this happened in 10 seconds or 2 seconds. That's not at all true. Our position is this occurred over 26 seconds from the moment of the tapes that we have and that we suggested to you. So what we have here is you have a possibility. You have the possibility here that the defendants and their version of the facts, which are based basically on the officers, by the way, the officers' testimony, in deposition, and this is something, a procedure I'd never heard of before also, the officer submitted an affidavit in this court of new facts, which contradicted his testimony in deposition, and also contradicted the sworn testimony of the supposed eyewitnesses, which are, I think, considered to be either reliable or unreliable. I never heard of such a procedure.
What are these contradictions?
Well, the officer testified in his deposition that to facts that are totally contrary to the claims made by the eyewitnesses. The officer claims, for instance, that Mr. McKinney had his hands in his pocket while he was charging him. He testified that that Mr. McKinney never threatened him or grabbed him or made any move in any way, shape, or form. If you read the officer's testimony, really, he undercuts everything the defendant claims occurred in this case. And therefore, Your Honor, what we have here, with all due respect,
is the officer's claims are in conflict with the defendant.
The officer's testimony is contrary to what the defendant is claiming here.
In the is it?
I understand, but I'm indicating to you that his testimony under oath doesn't support the claims that are made here, that this is somehow a justifiable shooting by a young man who's charging me and I had to shoot him. It's not supported. He didn't shoot him like that. The facts in this case established that Michael McKinney was shot in the back. The facts in this case established...
What did the pathologist say?
The pathologist said he was shot in the back.
Shot in the back.
That's correct. Michael Bodden...
How many times?
Twice. Michael Bodden and Werner Spitz. They've also measured the trajectory of the bullets, which is admissible in every criminal case that I dare say...
We're not talking about the fact that you can't have it, that information admissible. We get back to the gatekeeping function, and that's one of the problems you're facing, not that that type of evidence is inadmissible, but whether this particular evidence from these particular witnesses should have been admitted with regard to the summary judgment.
I understand that, and I'm just curious as to why in this case would otherwise widely recognized experts in a field that is used constantly in courts be somehow more suspect. I'm not familiar with any Dawber hearing that's ever been conducted, maybe the court is, in which it's claimed that experts in pathology or ballistics are somehow speculative or junk science.
Sure, they don't have to be. Obviously, they could be terrific.
Right.
The question is, in this case, what they said, and based on what they said, is how we evaluate.
Isn't a Dawber hearing based on whether the science is justified rather than whether somebody is right or wrong? I thought a Dawber hearing was based on whether the scientific theory was recognized generally, not whether one expert is right and another expert is wrong. That, therefore, is the battle of the experts.
Did the judge here address that at all?
Not that I'm familiar with. In other words, he didn't address whether the defendant's experts are right and whether the
plaintiff's... No, I don't mean that. There was an objection made to the admission of your expert testimony.
Based on speculation, and I don't believe that rises to the level of Dawber. The expert, the claim that was made was speculation. That's the Dawber. Dawber is whether the testimony of the expert is scientifically well-grounded. It's not speculation. Speculation might be an objection at trial, but it's not an objection under a Dawber theory. A Dawber theory examines whether the expert's opinions are grounded in science, and they're not junk science, so that, as you indicated, Your Honor, the gatekeeper function of the court is satisfied by not allowing people who come on, not because their opinions are disparate than somebody else's, but that their opinions are well-grounded in science. And I think the court summarily dismissed that claim because I don't think a legitimate claim can be made that there's not justifiable science for forensic pathologists or for ballistics experts. I think the claim of speculation is a trial issue. It is not an issue before this court. I think I've indicated that I think that this is a case involving a clearly disputed issues of fact where we've presented overwhelming testimony at our side. If what happened according to our facts is correct, as the district court indicated, we have a unjustifiable shooting, objectively unreasonable, arguably, and we have a clearly established constitutional right, the right to be free from the use of excessive force, if the facts that we set forth are believed by the jury. And that is the question here.
Mr. Slager, I think you have a point. Your time is expired.
Thank you very much.
How much time does counsel have? You have 2 minutes to wait.
Your Honors, we submit that the argument of counsel is not the same thing as a fact. This shot in the back innuendo that we've been dealing with for over a year now is a perfect example of that. The autopsy report reflected 2 shots to Mr. McKinney's front, shot to the left arm, shot to the left thigh. The autopsy photo clearly shows bullet wounds in those 2 locations. The estate's experts didn't say back. They hedged their opinion. I think they tried to say something like back left thigh, in that it was slightly behind the midline of the back of the thigh. But that didn't change what the autopsy report showed and what the district court specifically found. The district court adopted those autopsy findings as its findings, and the estate has not challenged that. but yet we have to deal with innuendos such as this.
It, with regard to this, the Daubert test, and counsel, your opposition says that it's merely whether this is recognized science, and then that's the sole thing the judge should look at, not speculation in giving an opinion. What's your view on that?
Speculation has always been, by definition, inadmissible under Daubert. These witnesses can be qualified. I think some of them were in the abstract, but they have to relate their qualifications and relate their opinions to some observable fact in the case, and that's what didn't happen. Let me give you another example of argument versus evidence. Officer Duplain testified that he couldn't see Mr. McKinney's hand as he stood by the tulip tree. Well, neither could the Ellisons. Both Ellisons testified that as Mr. McKinney was under that dense tulip tree, they couldn't see his hands either. We know from the testimony of the Ellisons that by the time Mr. McKinney reached Officer Duplain, his left hand was indeed out, because that's exactly what Mr. Ellis demonstrated. But that doesn't contradict Officer Duplain at all, and an argument doesn't make it so. Also, keep in mind that if you move your arm like that, your jacket pulls forward. All the experts for the estate did was examine the jacket. They never examined the body. But clothing is movable with relation to the body.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Thanks to both counsel in the case, and we'll take it under advice.